From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, how companies like Google and Facebook are controlling what we see on the internet. We'll talk with MoveOn.org's former executive director about his new book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Eli Pariser will tell us how companies are filtering what we see and why he thinks this kind of personalization comes at a high cost in terms of not just privacy, but also what we're learning and not learning online. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, if you and I use Google to search for something, let's say we both type in Exxon, we're going to get different search results that are unique to us. It wasn't always that way, but it is now, and it's one example of how internet companies are personalizing our use of the web. My guest this hour is not a big fan of personalization. In fact, Eli Pariser has written about the downsides and unintended consequences of it in his new book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. I should also mention that Eli Pariser is a former executive director of MoveOn.org, and he's now the board president. Eli, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's begin with sort of the obvious question. What do you mean by a filter bubble?
Well, you know, increasingly, websites are showing us the internet they think we want to see. So if you go to Google, as you said, you know, you get a different search result depending on who they think you are. And the same thing's true at Facebook, obviously, but also at news sites like Yahoo News, Amazon, Netflix. You know, there's this whole array of personalizing filters that surrounds us everywhere we go online. And what it creates is this kind of invisible, unique universe of information for each of us. It's a little different for everyone. That's what I call the filter bubble. It's this unique universe of information created just for us by these algorithms.
Now, Netflix did this quite a while ago. And I remember I don't belong to Netflix right now, but I did in the past. And, you know, they would say, well, if you like this film, you might like this. Or people who like this film might, you know, have also liked this, blah, blah, blah. Is that basically sort of a primitive form of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, you know, that's the basic thing. If you like this, you like that. And, you know, when it comes to Netflix, you know, it's very transparent. They say, this is why we're showing you this movie, because you liked this other movie. What's more concerning to me is that it's starting to happen invisibly. It's starting to happen in all sorts of places, kind of as a default part of your experience of the web. And because you can't see how your experience of the web is being edited, because you don't know who Google thinks you are or who Facebook thinks you are, you can start to miss things and not even know that you're missing them.
Now, the book begins, or the introduction begins, with a critical date, which you say was December 4th, 2009, when Google put something on its corporate blog. Tell us a little bit about that and what Google did and how that changed everything.
Well, you know, it was a blog post, and most people missed it. It wasn't a very long one, but it said personalized search for everyone. And when you unpacked what it meant is that even if you were logged out of, you know, Gmail, of Google services, and you went to Google something, you would get a personalized result. You would get a result that was specifically designed for you. And you know, this is very different from the place that Google started, which was with this algorithm called PageRank. And PageRank, you know, they explicitly, Larry Page and Sergey Brin explicitly talked about it as this kind of democratic thing where the web was voting for sort of the consensus best results. Now, what you see is not sort of the web's consensus about what the most authoritative result for Obama Middle East or, you know, whatever your query is. It's the result that you're the most likely to click. And when you're talking about, you know, the local pizza place, that's fine. But when you're talking about important political issues, you can see these massively diverging search results based on, you know, what they think you want to hear.
And you mentioned as an example in the book, BP, British Petroleum, that two people, I think you did this with two people who were sort of similar people that you knew, two women, I think. And they one typed it in and got sort of investment information, and the other one typed it in and the oil spill came up real big. So what was it about those two women that gave them such divergent results?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You know, I asked Google about this. I talked to the engineer who is responsible for this product, and he said, you know what, actually, in any given case, we don't really know. You know, we don't, this is an algorithm that has 200,000 lines of code or whatever it is. We don't actually know for any given person why it's giving the results it gives. We just know that in aggregate, it makes people click more. And, you know, so who knows, you know, what it thought the differences between these people were. The point is that they got different results, and that if we hadn't been doing the experiment that way, they never would have known it. I mean, in other words, I didn't know about that Google was tailoring my search results until I checked it out with a friend and saw how different they were.
And it's not just what comes up first, but how many results are found. I mean, there's a whole series of differences, right?
That's right. I mean, one of those people, one of the women that did the search, got 140 million search results. The other one got 180 million search results. This is a pretty, you know, 40 million search results, you know, were being left out. You know, and actually, though, you know, what really matters is most Google users click on one of the first three links. And those first three links, you know, that's 90% of the traffic. They were completely different. You know, that was sort of the major difference.
And you said it even continues if you log out of Gmail. I assume it does only work, though, in a meaningful way if you're using the same computer over and over. If you happen to be at a hotel and you go into the business center and use a computer, that's going to be more random, right?
Well, this is what's so interesting.
It doesn't know who you are when you log onto the computer, assuming you're not logging into your own account.
You'd think that, but a Google engineer told me that there are actually 57 what they call signals, 57 variables that they track. Even if you're totally logged out, if you take a new laptop out of the box and log on with it, that already says a lot about you. It says, you know, if you're logging on with a MacBook Air, it says something about your income level and your demographics. If you're using the Chrome browser versus the Internet Explorer browser, it says something. Your IP address that you're logging on from says something about where you are and, you know,
what you might be looking for.
And so there are all of these things. Even before you've told them your name, even before you've put in your zip code, that Google can use to infer what you might be interested in.
And all this stuff happens in a second.
That's right. No, it happens, you know, in milliseconds, and it happens totally invisibly. I mean, this is not something that's easy to identify unless you're actually, you know, sitting next to a friend.
And you said that Google uses 57 signals to sort of pigeonhole you, in a sense. What are some of the signals? What are some of the more interesting ones that we might not think about?
Well, one of the ones that I just found out about was how long your mouse hovers over a link before you click it. So if it hovers for more than 3 seconds,
they might be a Gemini.
You know, then
indecisive.
Right. No, I mean, but it makes sense from a certain point of view. Google wants to know, is this obviously the right result, or is this sort of you're deliberating, you're not sure if it's right? You know, and in a way, you know, what Google says is we're doing this so that we can actually provide the best results for you. We're doing it to improve our service. And my concern is, you know, that in the process of that, there are things that fall out, that if all you're trying to do is get people to click the most, then you miss important things. And the example that I used that I asked them about was I said, you know, if I'm a 9/11 conspiracy theorist and I Google 9/11, is it your job to show me the thing I'm most likely to click on, which is another conspiracy website?
To confirm your conspiracy.
You know, that would confirm my views. Or is it your job to show me the Popular Mechanics article that debunks all of that stuff?
What did they say?
Well, he said, you know, well, we'll have to get back to you on that. you know, and it, really, I think, you know, these companies are sort of, you know, they've come up so quickly that the immense responsibility that they have now, that so much of the information on the internet flows through them, they haven't really figured out exactly what to do with that in this particular context.
Now, as you point out in the book, Google's slogan is, I think, do no evil.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil. There we go. Is there an evil aspect to this? Or is it, you know, was it about business? Is it about, you know, monetizing, advancing all their revenues, keeping their, you know, the shareholders happy?
Yeah, I think it's more an unintended consequence of a business strategy. You know, this is, and it's not just Google, by the way. It's almost every major web company is investing heavily in this kind of personalization. And they do it because, you know, really, it helps them sell ads. And if they can give people stuff that is sort of narrowly relevant to them, then it'll keep them coming back. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, I start the book with this quote from Mark Zuckerberg. where he says, and he's describing, you know, why the news feed is so great at Facebook. And he says, a squirrel dying in your front yard may be more relevant to your interests right now than people dying in Africa. And, you know, he may be right. The squirrel may be more clickable. But actually, you know, we need to know about both of those things.
And what does it mean for our knowing about those things? Is it really so pervasive? You know, more and more people, of course, are getting their news from the internet. Does it mean that we're less likely? Do you think it means that we're less likely to learn about things that we don't want to know about? Is that one of the concerns?
Yeah, no. So as a thought experiment, think about the Facebook like button. So it's very easy to click like on your friend's post about how they just completed a marathon. And it's really uncomfortable to click like on an article someone posted about genocide in Darfur. And because Facebook mainly uses how many people like something as a way of figuring out what they should show to other people, what it means is that you see a lot of that kind of well-liked news on Facebook, and you don't see some stuff that's really important, but you know, not likable.
And you pointed out, I think, that Facebook's sort of struggled with what word to use, whether it was like or something else, and they settled on like for what reason?
Well, I think they thought that the positive valence would give people a good user experience. A thing that I learned after, you know, the book was published was that they debated having a dislike button as well. And the theory about why that didn't come to pass, which I find pretty compelling, is that advertisers didn't want people to be able to say, I dislike Coca-Cola or I dislike Walmart. You know, they didn't want that to be public. So the nice thing about a like button is you can't really offend an advertiser that way. You can get less likes, but you can't get dislikes. This is the problem in a way, which is that Facebook touches 1 in 14 people on Earth now. A massive amount of information flows through it. And increasingly, for a lot of people, it is the place that they get their news. And if all they're getting is the stuff that people are sort of most likely to click on, it's most likely to keep them on Facebook, then they're not really learning about everything there is to know about the world.
Eli Pariser is our guest this hour on Forum. He's written a new book called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. You know, when I walk into a bookstore sometimes, and there are a few bookstores left, sometimes I feel a little overwhelmed because, you know, I see the nonfiction section, I see the new book section, the hardbacks, the paperbacks, and when you go to Amazon or some other website where you get directed in this way, it can be helpful. It can narrow the choices in a way that's useful. Are you saying that you're not saying that it's all downside, are you?
No, I think you know, actually, we'll need personalization to help us sort through the masses of information that we're confronted with every day. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, you know, talks about that the same amount of information that was created from the beginning of history to 2003 was created in the last 3 days. You know, and if you think about that for a minute, then you recognize this is a big problem, and you need tools to help you sort through it in a compelling way. The problem is that right now, the variables that those tools are looking at and the things that they're trying to optimize for are, you know, really basically how to get people to click on stuff more. And in a way, you know, this is analogous to newspapers in the early part of the 1900s. Newspapers, you know, became this very important information source. They were mainly focused on sensationalism and selling papers and putting whatever they wanted on the front. It was only after World War I that people started to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is the place that citizens are built. This is the place where people get information that allows them to make good voting decisions. And if they don't, you know, take better care about their front page and really balance it and try to give people a good flow of information, then, you know, we're not going to have a very strong democracy. I think that's sort of the pivot that we need to make online now. You know, Google is sort of in the place that those newspapers were in 1915. It can choose just to be a profit-making entity, or it can choose to do something better and bigger to actually help build citizens in the 21st century world.
You know, as I said at the top, you were still the board president of MoveOn.org, and were instrumental in the early days. And that is a very influential political site for the left. And I wonder if you see any overlap between what you're describing in terms of with what MoveOn is trying to do, which is to really bring those people in who are like-minded and influence our democratic process.
Yeah, no. The difference between MoveOn though, and the filter bubble, is that that MoveOn essentially is an opt-in. You know, you're choosing to turn on this filter, and I would never suggest that someone just get their news from MoveOn. I think it's good, but I would always recommend that people get news from a variety of sources. In any case, you're choosing it, and what's different about these automatic filters that are increasingly surrounding us online is that you're not choosing it. They're invisible. They're automatically on. They follow you wherever you go. It's very hard to escape your own point of view. And, unlike something like Twitter, where you can subscribe to someone and see everything they say on sites like Facebook and Google, you're seeing an edited view of the world that's more likely to conform with your own beliefs.
Although on Facebook, you can change that by hitting everyone, all news, as opposed to just what they think you want to see based on who you contact most often and click on the most often, right?
Well, this is actually an interesting thing. A lot of people think that if you click over to the, the full feed, that's everything. It's not, as it turns out. It's still quite edited in terms of what you see. So it's you see more of what everyone is doing, but you don't actually see the full picture even then.
What's it edited on the basis of what?
Well, on the basis of all these same things,
still.
It's still Facebook is trying to show you the stuff that you're most likely to engage in. And when I talked to an engineer there, he said, really we're focused on one thing, which is how do you keep people on Facebook as much as possible? And we're constantly trying to find new ways of using the data that we have to keep people on Facebook more. And these other problems that you're talking about, these aren't, these are hard problems that aren't as interesting to optimize for as this very simple thing of how do you increase the number of minutes that people stay on Facebook?
I was on the New York Times website yesterday and was going to link up with Facebook. And there's a disclosure that comes up and says, basically, if you agree to do this, you're letting the New York Times look in your data, get access to your website, blah, blah, all these things, which seemed extremely intrusive. And I just said, no, I don't want to do that. I said, no. So in that sense, it may be transparent in that you're being told if you join Facebook through the New York Times, but then you forget about it. And the New York Times then does what with that information?
Well, I mean, this is, and not necessarily, Facebook is actually very, very, very acquisitive of data for itself and miserly with it when it comes to its partners. So the New York Times probably isn't getting that much data out of the deal.
But they have access to everything you've put on Facebook.
But they have access to that information, and they use it to tailor, what stories you see. And, I think this is a really notable thing that you're shifting from this human editorial model, and the New York Times is sort of the primary proponent of this that says, editors are there to find out everything that's going in, all the news that's fit to print, right? All of the things that you need to know. And to put on the front page a mix of stories that will entertain you and stories that, are about something like the war in Afghanistan that you just need to know about. And now there's this shift to this algorithmic editing that is doing a lot of the same things, but that doesn't have that sense of public responsibility that the Times editors, mostly do.
And in fact, on the back of your book, on the jacket cover, George Lakoff, in a little blurb, is quoted as saying, in the filter bubble, Eli Pariser reveals the new slogan of the personalized internet, only the news that fits you, we print. a little play on the New York Times slogan.
Yeah, that's right. And my concern is, it feels very good, right? I mean, the reason that these sites are doing this is that actually, to be greeted like an old friend with all of the articles that you're the most interested in and all of the opinions that reflect your own viewpoints, it feels great. You feel like, boy, I'm just so right about everything. And you come back. But it's a very dangerous kind of comfort because to make good decisions, you actually need to see the full picture, and you need to get outside of your sort of very narrow view of the world.
What, from an ethics point of view or a corporate responsibility point of view, what would you like to see companies like Google and Facebook and Yahoo and all the rest do to make this less insidious, if you will?
Well, you know, I think the first thing they can do is make it more transparent that they're editing your experience of the web. So, for example, in Google's case, you could signal to people more, you know, this search result is a search result that everybody's getting. This search result we've tailored just for you. And that would be a start in helping people understand why they're getting this kind of information and what they can do with it. But I think, you know, you have to do more than that. I think it actually comes down to giving people some control so that they can adjust what they're seeing rather than letting these algorithms, control what they see and what they don't. And, you know, from an engineering standpoint, some of these things are hard. Some of them are pretty simple. You could have a slider at the top of Google that says, you know, on the left is search results that are most for people just like you, and on the right is search results for people totally different than you. You can, you know, use the same algorithms that you're using to personalize to actually give people, you know, a real diversity of information and allow them to adjust it themselves.
What do you think users would do if they had that option?
Well, I'd like to think that they would, you know, often keep it in the middle. You know, that you'd want to see kind of a balance of personal relevance and social relevance. And I think really what we're moving toward is a world in which people are sort of more algorithmically literate, where people know how to use these tools to adjust their information feeds and get an good information flow. And partly that depends on consumers to get more educated about how this all works and why it's happening. But partly it also depends on these companies offering people the tools to actually do something about it. And this is sort of one of my frustrations, is that there's this catch-22 where the companies say, you know, we don't offer those tools because nobody is interested in it and nobody knows about it. And I say, well, people don't know about it because you don't offer the tools. It's not obvious that this is all happening. You know, it has to start somewhere.
The internet is, in a way, sort of an adolescent. You know, it hasn't been around that long. Where do you see, and we only have about a minute here, but where do you see this going? I mean, engineers are very interested in refining these algorithms, right?
Well, I really think we're at a fork in the road, and you could imagine that the internet goes down this sort of path of consolidation, or you could imagine that you know, people say, we actually do want this to live up to its potential, and we want it to connect us with ideas that are different, and, you know, get these companies to live up to that promise of the internet that we all, you know, heard about at the beginning.
And the hope is that as that goes on, that there's a responsibility, that people will take their own responsibility for not getting sort of sucked into this little pigeonhole, too.
That's right. But, you know, and I think there's a lot of individual responsibility, but to do that, you also have to actually understand how this is all working to begin with. And hopefully that's what the book helps people do.
Eli Pariser, his book is called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. And we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page at kqed.org/Facebook. I think I may have said that wrong. Go to Facebook and facebook.com/forum, KQED forum. You'll find it. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Eli Pariser, and we'll take your calls in the next half hour. And we continue now with Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. My guest is Eli Pariser. His new book is called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You, all about the personalization of the internet. Give us a call if you'd like to weigh in on this, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. or post a comment on our website, or go to the KQED forum page as well. Let's go to the phones. Why don't we go to Rick in San Francisco? Welcome. Rick, are you there? Well, let's try Erlinda in Santa Clara. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. I'm an academic librarian, and you know, I work in a college campus. We have 70 computers in the library. Of course, we want our students to have authoritative results, the best results they can find. Say they're doing a Google search. Now, how would the preferences be, messed up because the result rankings messed up because it's a public public computers that hundreds of students might use a day.
Eli?
Well, it's a great question, and one of the challenges with these algorithms is that it's very hard to tell what will happen in any particular case. You'd kind of imagine that if you were thinking like the Google algorithm, that you would be able to notice computers that a lot of different kinds of people are using, that you would notice that the traffic from this IP looks like traffic from other libraries elsewhere, and you would be customizing the results to give you, sort of library, the best library results, and working at that level. But it's very unclear, how this actually works, and because it's invisible, you'd really have to sit down with other people and look at screens side by side to tell. The one thing I will say is, there are some things that you can do to downgrade the amount of personalization. It doesn't remove it completely. But for Google, if you're searching in a private browser window that removes kind of the whole web history and removes your cookies, it's less personalized. It's not unpersonalized, but it's certainly going to give you a somewhat less unique result.
Erlinda, do you think your students think much about this or care about it?
Well, we want them to care, of course. whether they do or not is another question. So, it's too bad there isn't kind of a neutral opt-out button where you can just get pure results. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's...
pure results based on what's the best authoritative sources.
Yeah,
I mean there are ways we can do that by limiting sites. Like often we go to a site, and limit it to .gov or certain ways we can, teach the
right.
students to do that
yeah.
and do advanced searches, which gets some better results. But it's very difficult when, they put in a search and they get over 1 million results. I mean, it's just bewildering. And, they'll go for the easiest first.
The first few, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the call. And, Eli, you mentioned in the book, too, that you can sort of throw this off the track a little bit by just putting in searches for things that, don't reflect your own point of view or things that you really care about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you in theory, at least, you can throw this off the track. The challenge is that the strongest signal is sort of the historical one. So if you've been using Google for 3 years on the same computer with the same login, then it knows a lot about you. One day of sort of randomly clicking on things probably isn't going to get you out of the bubble that you're in.
And you said there are some things that they downplay, certain kinds of searches or things that you do that the algorithm sort of automatically de-emphasizes?
Well, different algorithms do different things. One interesting question that people wrestle with is, for example, how long of your history do you look at? If you look at the whole history, then you may be sort of locking people into an old version of themselves. If you imagine like a meat eater who becomes a vegetarian, and is searching for dinner recipes, and getting steak recipes. On the other hand, if you look at too short of a window, then you lose the kind of consistency and you have this sort of profile of people that's moving all over the place. The challenge is that in some ways, we're very easily stereotyped. So I was talking to someone at a company called Hunch, and Hunch is a kind of opt-in personalizer. And they say that with five questions answered about you, they can make a prediction about almost any other question with an 80% accuracy. So you really don't need that much to get good enough to be making these companies money, even if it's not a very good portrait of who you are.
What are the questions?
Well, it's questions about that are proxies for your gender, your political kind of orientation, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, and there are a couple others. These are sort of basic things, but if you know those things, then you can predict like which restaurants people will want, what kind of wine they'll enjoy, a whole bunch of different things. And Hunch actually has a lot of great examples on its site.
866-733-6786, the number to call, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. Let's go up to Sebastopol now. Jeff's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to comment a little bit of a different perspective, perhaps, and one that perhaps doesn't pay as much attention to commerce as is realistic, but pays more attention to responsible social discourse, which is that the idea of a balanced perspective is not necessarily accurate. It's kind of like Fox's version of fair and balanced. Balance isn't necessarily fair, nor is it necessarily accurate. If there was an algorithm that paid attention to factual data, then people would be able to see the top results based on known facts. Otherwise, I think results should be completely unfiltered, and people can make their own decisions as responsible citizenry should make. But I'm a proponent of the Joe Friday, just the facts model.
Well, there are facts and there are facts, huh, Eli? I mean...
Well, and this is one of the challenge. You know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan famously said, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinions, but not our own facts. Now it's increasingly possible, thanks to these, you know, personalized filters, to actually have your own facts as well. You know, you can live in a world where climate change doesn't exist, you know, where the climate isn't changing already, even though the scientists all say that it is. And that's, you know, very simple. And you can also live in a world where there isn't any kind of doubt about that, which, of course, there is as well. What I'd like to see is, you know, one of the things that a newspaper front page has that these algorithms don't is a sense of representativeness. It's a sense of this is kind of a map of what is happening in the world. And even if you don't, you know, even if you're not interested, even if you're not inclined to agree with everything, at least you kind of have a dashboard of this is everything that I need to know about. That's something that you can miss when you're in one of these very sort of tightly relevant bubbles.
And, you know, that's personally what I like about a newspaper, actually physically having a newspaper. I know it's those are legacy media, but you know, you get a sense of what the editors think is most important in terms of the layout, where things are placed, how long they are, what kind of headline they get, and you lose some of that, I think, online, especially if you log in to the news site and they begin to personalize your view of the paper, right?
Right. You know, we're in very early days here for personalization, and I think when we look back on this, hopefully, it'll be obvious, you know, how primitive this was relative to what we had before, in a way. You know, there's so much information packed into a newspaper front page that's not in a list of the top 10 recommended stories. You know, all of that visual information, the headlines and the placement of them. And hopefully, you know, what can happen is that as these algorithms become more sophisticated, and if they build in this, you know, these other kinds of things to prioritize besides just what people will click the most, you'll start to reproduce some of those same valuable values that informed the newspaper in these algorithmic feeds.
Give us a call at 866-733-6786 if you'd like to talk to Eli Pariser about his book, The Filter Bubble. We'd love to hear your thoughts about how do you personalize your own access to the news? And do you prefer to have things sort of narrowed down for you, or do you want to get it all and just to see what it all looks like? 866-733-6786. Let's go to Laura in San Francisco. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Eli. It was interesting. I just saw your TED piece last night, so it was kind of a funny coincidence.
You're in a filter bubble.
Yes, and it came through Facebook, and I'm always shocked that people get news on Facebook. But I think that we all filter our news. Some people choose to watch Fox versus the NewsHour. And so we have these self-imposed, I think, filters. And it's interesting. I get my news. I look at The Week, which is a compilation of many news places. And it's everything's gotten so polarized. And you can, even reading these clips from different news organizations, you can totally see through their political stance. I get news from the New York Times, from the Wall Street Journal. I watch the NewsHour. Sometimes when I go to the gym, I'll turn on Fox TV just to see. Now, that nobody knows I'm doing that, you know, in the internet space.
And only your fellow exercisers.
A really interesting thing happened to me the other day. I was helping my nephew look for an internship in engineering. Uh-huh. And I was doing a search for a company. And 5 minutes later, a I got a job link for senior engineering job because I'm currently in a job search, and it posted it to me. So it already had that. And it thought I was looking for engineering jobs, so that was really spooky.
Eli, we're talking a lot about news, but as she points out, there are a lot of other aspects to our lives that this really has an impact on.
Right, and you know, one of the interesting things about this is that it all feeds into the same pool of data. So the data that can be used to personalize your news can also be used to personalize your ads, and it moves incredibly quickly. When I looked into this, there really is this emerging kind of behavior market behind the scenes of the internet, where every click that you make and every website that you look at has a value as a signal about what kind of person you are, but what kind of products you might be interested in. And the companies that are behind this, the 800-pound gorilla is this company called Axiom. And they have an incredible amount of information on each of us, about 1,500 points of data on the average American. They had more data about the 9/11 hijackers on the day after 9/11 than the federal government did. And they have a lot of interest in collecting as much information about us as possible to use to personalize our news and to use to personalize our ads, but also to use to make decisions about us. Banks, for example, are starting to make decisions about who they offer credit lines to based on the credit worthiness of their Facebook friends. Now, it's very predictive. If you have a lot of friends who are deadbeats, then according to the banks, you're much more likely to, default on your loans. But
So they go in and look at you. How do they get access to your information from this company, Axiom?
Well, there are a bunch of companies that have basically kind of scraped the data out of Facebook. There's a company called Rapleaf based here in San Francisco that does that. And you can look at who someone is friends with, look at their credit scores, and even if you know nothing about them, you can make a prediction about how likely they are to repay their loans. Now, the danger here, which should be obvious, is, does this mean that you shouldn't, you should defriend, right? You should defriend your old high school, old high school buddy who's in some financial trouble. I hope not, but this is the way that this data can be used to make decisions about, the kinds of services that you get.
We've got some email here. Catherine writes, I love the idea of getting a viewpoint different from my own, a very difficult thing when I'm surrounded by people with similar values and beliefs. How feasible is it to create an algorithm to ask for results that are diametrically opposed to the ones I've received? Could this be done outside of a website or maybe create an anti-Google?
Right. Well, I was talking about this at YouTube yesterday, and someone suggested, maybe along with the if you like this video, you'll like this one, they should do. If you like this video, you'll probably not like this other one. And, I looked into it. There's actually a site called Library Thing, which does this with books. And it's very funny. The example they use is if you liked The Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant, then you probably won't like Confessions of a Shopaholic, which seemed, about right. Obviously, at the extreme, these services wouldn't be that useful. But I do think that there's a value in kind of daring people to get outside of their own viewpoint and to say, here's something that a lot of people who thought different from you really liked that you should check out and that you should know about.
What did the engineers say about that?
Oh no, they were sort of amused by the idea. I don't know that it's going to be coming out on YouTube anytime soon. But I do think offering people diversity of opinion and giving people the tools to actually see what they're missing would be a great thing.
Another email from Chris in Berkeley. She writes, I was wondering if your guest could speak about the perspective of a small business, perhaps advertising with Google AdWords, and how this might affect this type of advertising.
Well, the interesting thing about advertising, in theory, these tools are available to anyone. But in practice, the big companies have a big head start because the more data that you have, the more finely you can kind of target and tune the advertising that you're doing. So everyone kind of hoped that Facebook and Google would help small businesses do relatively better, and small entrepreneurs kind of get a leg up against the big chains. Right now, it's not looking that way. Right now, it's looking like the big chains can afford to do the data mining to figure out their target customers and get them for less, and the small businesses just don't have the reach to be able to do that kind of thing.
What's the relationship with this personalization and a site like Yelp?
Well, Yelp, is increasingly going in this direction. And in a way, you know, all of this is exacerbating something that's already happening in our society anyway, which is that people are increasingly kind of self-sorting geographically. And even within a city, you know, they'll sort of self-sort to be with people like them. There's a book called The Big Sort that describes this phenomenon and talks about how in the last 30 years, there's this massive shift in how likely it is that your neighbor is someone like you. What a site like Yelp does is amplify that phenomenon, because now, even if you're in a city that has lots of different kinds of people, you're going to restaurants for people like you, or you're going to events for people like you. You know, you're sort of with the same cohort wherever you go. And again, that's very cozy. But, the things that you stumble upon, the things that you come to by serendipity, are often like some of the best human experiences, you know, where you are surprised or you find yourself, challenged in a way that you never expected.
You know, we're talking about this as a kind of a brave new world sort of thing, but it's, in some ways, isn't it kind of retro, you know, a throwback? You grew up in a small town in Maine. I grew up in a suburb of Buffalo, New York. And there were a lot of people years and years and years ago, a century ago, living in small towns, and everyone in their community, that's who they came in contact with. They didn't have contact with people all over the world. So there was probably more of a kind of a homogeneity. Are we, in a sense, going back to that, do you think?
Well, in some ways, there is a homogeneity. But when you look at, for example, cross-class relationships, Robert Putnam, the sociologist at Harvard, has been looking at this and has seen a precipitous drop in cross-class relationships in the last 30 or 40 years. The likelihood that you know someone from a very different social class is just going down and down and down. And when you think about that small town experience, you know, I did know the rich guy in town, and I knew, you know, some of the people were really hard put on. You know, it was the full spectrum, because there just weren't that many people around. What this stuff allows you to do is really just narrow, you know, zoom in on your precise little slice of the world. And importantly, to sort of block out the rest of it, that you don't even see, what these other people are experiencing, the problems that are facing them. You're just seeing the media that's suited to you.
866-733-6786, the number to call, or shoot us an email, forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Bill in Palo Alto. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I have two questions. First one is there any benefit in going to sites like Wikipedia that have essentially aggregated viewpoints or selectivity on the part of their users? The second question is, are employers using search information to refine their hiring processes for potential applicants that they're either seeing or screening online, or using that tool otherwise to supplement their the people they're seeing on a direct basis? And I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call. Eli?
Great questions. I am a big fan of Wikipedia for precisely this reason, that if you go to the Barack Obama webpage on Wikipedia, you know, you find this very carefully calibrated, factually oriented discussion of who this guy is. And it includes some of the conservative critiques of him. It includes some of, you know, his supporters' opinions about him, but it's a very it's all of that information in one place. That's sort of the one major website right now that's sort of running counter to this trend. They don't do any personalization at Wikipedia, and they encourage you to sort of randomly surf through their articles and learn about things that you never expected to come across. To your second question, I do think this is one of the really cutting edge places where all of this is happening, and it's very concerning, because it's very easy, it's easier than ever to buy data about people and to get a full rundown of exactly who this person is and where they've been and what they've clicked on. what you do with that, you never have to disclose to anyone who's applying for a job, for example, you know, that you're necessarily using any of that information to make a decision. And yet it can be used to you know, make these really important decisions about what happens to you. You know, and when you move into the sort of algorithmic hiring process, which a lot of companies are starting to offer, you know, software that'll help you sift through applicants and find the right person, you can get into real segregation trouble, basically, where, you know, for example, if the algorithm says, you know, 9 of the last 9 employees have been white, therefore we're going to filter out all of the non-white applicants that, you know, that are coming in, that's obviously a big problem, and that could happen without you even really knowing it.
You're listening to Forum. If you want to join our conversation this morning, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Our guest this hour is Eli Pariser. His new book is called The Filter Bubble. And, of course, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. Let's go back to the phones now, and another caller from Palo Alto, Jessica, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I really agree with your guest, and I find it really difficult to find multiple stories to come up with your own conclusion on things. And so I just wanted to put out there something that I found on the iPad is newsy.com, and I don't know if your guest is familiar with it, but...
What is it? Tell us a little bit about it.
It's a news feed that pulls the videos from like Fox and MSNBC, BBC, and then it'll even pull text from Wall Street Journal and Al Jazeera and take one topic and report from all those different sources on it. Hmm. And their taglines are so cheesy, but they're so great. It says... multiple sources, the real story, and then making you smarter faster.
What do you think? Are there companies like this or news websites like this that are sort of bucking the trend?
Yeah, no. I mean, this is a very open space, and I haven't looked at Newsy, but now I will. But I think, you know, there are a lot of startups that are starting to think about how do you bring together the... you know, the things that algorithmic personalization does, the things that the filter bubble does, and, you know, these values that are embedded in 20th century journalism about diversity of opinion, about, you know, sticking to the facts, about, you know, telling people not just what they want to know, but what they need to know. And I think, you know, the question is whether the big companies that are making a lot of money on personalization, Google and Facebook and these other companies, stick with the strategy of just narrowly looking at, you know, what people click and giving them more of that. Or, you know, do they move more in this direction that some of these other sites are experimenting with of, you know, really trying to serve people as citizens and not just as consumers?
Here's another email from Joel who writes, what can I do to find an unfiltered result? Is there a special website? Can I change settings on Chrome, IE, or Firefox to get closer to a non-personalized result? We talked a little bit about that earlier.
Well, you know, you can use a private browsing window, which... reduces some of that. I have a list.
How do you access that? Just
in any major browser, you know, there's a private browsing or incognito window that's fairly self-explanatory. I have a full list of tips on the website for the book, thefilterbubble.com. You can check that out if you're interested. But the challenge is it's really hard right now because the technology and the sort of the financial incentives to do this are so much greater than the financial incentives to help people block it. And really, that's what I'm hoping that this book will help change is as more people become aware of this, consumers will demand it more and companies will respond to that.
There was a hearing today in the U.S. Senate looking at some of privacy concerns around smartphones, and there were some executives there from Apple and Google. Is there a role for government regulation here, do you think?
Well, I do think that we probably need a reset of the rules around personal information. You know, the laws that we have on the books right now are 30 or 40 years old. They weren't that good then, but they really don't work in a world in which all of these tiny bits of personal information have such an amazing value to these companies, and in which consumers can give them off so freely and unwittingly, and in which they can be traded for money behind our backs without our even knowing it. You know, it just seems like we need a new paradigm that, you know, resets the balance towards consumers a bit, while allowing these companies to provide some services that people find genuinely valuable.
But the notion of privacy, I mean, it's really kind of gone out the window, hasn't it, to a large degree?
Well, I think, you know, privacy is really about people having control over their own information. And I think it still is possible for people to have control over their,
is it really?
You know, of their over their own information.
I mean, you talked about the company in San Francisco that is able to scrape information out of Facebook. For
oh example. No, but what I'm saying is, there's no technological reason why people couldn't have control over their information. It's just that all of these companies sort of start with the premise that, you know, why would anyone want that? I think actually most people want to have control over their information, and if there are people who start to provide better tools for doing that and for deciding to whom to reveal what and giving people some agency in this, you'll find that a lot of people want that.
Just quickly, we have a few seconds left. What do you do to, you know, kind of get yourself out of this personalization?
Well, you know, I really do try to sort of cobble together a bunch of different sources. On Facebook, I try to cultivate a lot of other friends. And then, you know, at the same time, I'm still stuck in my bubble. Facebook doesn't show me my conservative friends because it thinks I'm not as interested in them.
Yeah. Well, keep in touch with those deadbeat friends in high school.
That's
one message here. All right. Eli Pariser's new book is called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, with help this week from Tina Larberg and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Nathan Falk, Adam Hill, Katrina Schwartz, and Vinny Tong. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.